Welcome to Steppin' Out, the 12-step meeting on the air. Tonight you'll meet real people with true stories of addiction and recovery. And now, Steppin' Out.
Hello and welcome to America's 12-step radio show. My name is Drew and this is Steppin' Out. The stories you're about to hear are real. It's a 12-step meeting on the air. So kick back, listen in, because if you ever wondered what went on inside those 12-step meetings, you're going to find out right now. We have guests here from Al-Anon to share with us their experience, their strength, and their hope. And first up, we have Christopher. Christopher, how you doing, man?
Hi, Drew. I'm real good. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. Welcome.
Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up with an alcoholic or an addict and what it's like now.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful to hear the other people's stories. I really relate to what they've been talking about. What I keyed in most when I was listening to their stories and thinking about my own life and my own childhood, I grew up with both parents drinking until my dad left and I was about 8 years old. And I was thinking about the isolation.
Okay.
And that's something that I really key into that. The kind of isolation. I've got a great sponsor in this program, and there's something that he's fond of saying, is that the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is indifference.
Interesting.
And that happened to me a lot as a kid, and I think it happens to a lot of us who grow up in alcoholic homes, that we end up with parents who try, you know, and a lot of the stuff gets taken care of, but there's a kind of indifference. Where they're just, because of their addictions, they're just not able. My parents were not able to show up for a lot of stuff, and that
it hurts.
Really, yeah, it hurts. It wreaks havoc on a kid.
I can imagine. So, I mean, you're really feeling just kind of withdrawn and not given. You're really denied love, so to speak, growing up, and that's kind of what causes this.
Issue.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, as a kid, you know, say you need, you know, X amount of love. And you get half of X.
Okay.
And you try to, you know, I try to deal with it and you try to live your life and move forward as a kid. But it really hurts later on.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, let's talk about your childhood a little bit. You know, again, you use the word indifference as being the absence of love. I think that's a pretty accurate statement from what I've heard from the other guests from Al-Anon who have been in here. Where do you go from that position of indifference? What do you do to get the approval and attention that you so desire? I mean, there's obviously a deep thirst for that as a child. How do you get that?
Where did I go? I went to other adults. I went to other people who were just older than me, 5 years, 10 years older. I hung out with a much older group of kids, and I tried to reinvent my mother and my father.
Okay.
And I would find these, women and men who were, you know, they were just teenagers themselves. I was, you know, 10 or something, and they'd be in high school or college, and they'd be drinking a lot or smoking a lot, doing drugs, and we would hang out, and I would assign the role of mother and father to these people in order to try to feel whole again. I did that a lot. It was crazy, and it got really unhealthy. And then it becomes confusing too, because I became attracted to older women, and then the sexual stuff comes up, and it's like, what am I trying to invent here? And that was really confusing, and I was looking to be loved and to be cared for over and over and over with people who were not able to do it.
Were you trying to, I mean, by using different people, different places and things, were you trying to reinvent this portrait of a family that you had never quite got?
Yeah, I was trying to invent a place where I could share my feelings, where I could share the sadness, where that would be understood, where I would be cared for. And I was looking for people who I thought could care for me. And that was really unrealistic. I mean, as a child, I never realized that, but it's unrealistic to turn to, you know, a person and expect that kind of mothering or fathering. It was unrealistic and it didn't always work out. I loved these people and they really loved me back. But then we would hit the wall, because either they were addicts or they would just see that I have what some of us call the God-sized hole.
This huge, God-sized hole.
Yeah, it's like a phrase we use in the program. And when we say that, or when I say that, what I'm talking about is this huge void that I needed to fill. And some people stuff it with food. Some people stuff it with sleep. Some people stuff it with addictions. And I tried to fill it with relationships, with finding like a new mother, a new father,
gotcha.
A kind of stability, a regularity that I never had. And it didn't work out. You know, I tried over and over and over, and it didn't work out. And I'm very grateful I eventually, the program found me, or I found the program. I don't know.
Let me back you up a little bit. Back to your parents drinking. What was, are they still, do they still drink today?
My parents drink about every day, yeah.
Every day?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Still, so you have to, I mean, you can't just not see your folks, so you still have to maintain a relationship with them with some degree of sanity.
And, I do. I love them. Yeah. They love me very much. We get together on a limited basis, and I try not to make the mistake of calling it a vacation. Like some people say, you know, oh, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to go see my family for 4 days. But I've learned to not say that.
Okay.
I do go see them, and sometimes I have a really good time.
Okay.
But there's also a lot of, I become very frightened and afraid, and I become a really different person, and it's not easy, but they're lovely people. They really love me. I really love them. And we try to work through it. They're not interested in connecting with the Al-Anon program or the AA program or anything like that. They just want to be who they are. And
do they think that, I mean, obviously they're still drinking, so there's still some denial there. I mean, do they think that they're not alcoholic? Or let me rephrase that. Their son's an Al-Anon. What does that say about them?
Sometimes I think they find it threatening because I have shared it with them. And especially when I was new to the program 2 years ago, after maybe 4 months in the program, I shared with them, "Hey, I found this amazing program," and I didn't want to blame them, you know, but I wanted it to be their miraculous wake up call,
okay.
And I wanted them to go to AA, and then I went through this crazy transformation where I thought, oh no, I've told them about Al-Anon, they're going to kill themselves, and I became really paranoid. This may sound bizarre, but I became paranoid that my mother would become depressed and might even kill herself.
Wow.
Because I was blaming her. And then I was really frightened about that. And then after a while, I realized that, you know, I've just got to detach from it. If they ever want to find the kind of miracles that happen in AA or the miracles that happen in Al-Anon, that's their right to find that kind of recovery. But I can't really lead them to it. You can't make them drink from the well of recovery.
Gotcha.
I've just got to let them walk their own life. And maybe one day, if things get really difficult or painful, maybe they will reach out and they'll find a kind of recovery. But also, they have their own guidance in life, and I'm going to let them go. You know?
Did you come into Al-Anon with the expectation that they would get sober?
No, I came with why did I come to this program? I came to this program because I was my own behavior. I was in a relationship that crashed. I was married to a woman who was kind of workaholic and was very detached. And she was not alcoholic, I'll admit that. But when she left the marriage, when she left me and left our marriage, I became kind of violent and suicidal.
How so? Specifically,
I walked down the street trying to punch out a bunch of windows at a construction site in the middle of the day. That was really bizarre.
The rage just got you.
Yeah, the rage really got to me, and I ended up jumping in the East River. Actually,
really?
It was October, and I jumped in the East River for I don't know what I was doing in the East River, and then I eventually climbed out and made a couple phone calls to an alcoholic friend. And
was it a suicide attempt or something, or what was the point of that? Or were you just so, I mean, what, yeah.
What is, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, what's
you
that
know,
all about?
That's a pattern that I hope, I don't know.
All right. You know what? We'll revisit it possibly later, okay? Again, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Christopher. Christopher was telling us about, I think the quote, if I got it right, was the absence, the reverse of love isn't hate, it's
indifference.
Indifference. And that indifference drove you into highly dysfunctional relationships where you're seeking the approval of I mean, what was this
yeah.
thing like? I mean, you had just
yeah,
left
yeah.
us at a point where you were at a construction site punching holes in the window. You freaked out. You jumped in the East River just to feel something. Is that right?
Yeah, it was great during the break. I remembered, why did I jump in the East River? And I remember that week I was walking around and I had this part-time job, and I was walking around on my lunch break, and I remember not being able to even feel the street. I couldn't feel my feet on the ground. I was so frightened and angry. My thinking I've just become really ill and frightened, and that loneliness got so big. And that's why I jumped in the river, was because I thought, you know, that river's going to be real cold and it's going to fix me right up.
Wow.
And so that's, I thought it would be, in a way, I thought it would be refreshing. And in another way, I wanted to die. I wanted to be some crazy accidental statistic, you know, of some, you know, nice young guy who jumped in the river and got swept away.
Wow.
So I'm not sure. So I didn't know what I wanted, but I know I wanted to feel something. I wanted to feel alive again. I wanted to get in touch with this huge quantity of feelings, which for years I'd been stuffing and stuffing and stuffing. And the programs taught me that, yeah, you can stuff things down so far, but one day it's really helpful to go looking for the truth. If you don't go looking for the truth, someday it'll find you, and you might not be ready for it.
Right.
And so I wanted to feel something, and the programs taught me that little by little I can try to find the truth in my life and own terms.
What happened after this episode in the river with the – was it a divorce? Or did you guys –
Yeah, yeah.
And was this around that time where –
Yeah, it was totally around that time. So okay. I called some of my trusted friends. They recommended a therapist. I saw this therapist. After a couple months in therapy – she recommended, why don't you read about ACOA issues?
ACOA being?
Adult Children of Alcoholic Issues.
Okay.
And I said, well, my parents drink every day, but I'm not going to use the word alcoholic. And she's like, hey, let's not blame them. Why don't you just go read a book?
Okay.
And so I went out and got a couple of paperback self-help books. And they were amazing. They were written by doctors, but one of the things that they kept saying at the end of each chapter was, hey, by the way, if you want to speed this up and get to the core, why don't you check out an Al-Anon meeting? And I thought, okay, here are these doctors writing these self-help books, but after each chapter, that's what they would go back to. And I thought, all right. And so I found my first Al-Anon meeting in some YMCA basement, I never felt so at home. I never felt so loved. I'd never heard, particularly men, I never sat down to a bunch of men and heard men talk about the fear, the fear and the anguish and the discontent, that kind of that they were feeling. I never heard men talk like that.
Yeah, and it is rare. I mean, what's the makeup of Al-Anon today, male to female? What do you see in the meetings?
I go to some meetings that are 50-50.
That's amazing because, as you know, historically, that had been usually the wives of the drinkers back then.
Yep, and now it's back in the late 50s. Yeah. That's how it was created. But times
have changed.
In fact, and I'd go to a men's meeting
on
the Upper West Side. Can I say that?
Sure.
And I go to this men's meeting, and it's all men.
Wow.
From age 25 to age 75. It's a huge group of amazing men who share their experience, strength, and hope. It's amazing.
And were you, the men that you're in recovery with, were they as stifled emotionally prior to coming to Al-Anon?
Yeah, the disease affects people in different ways. Some people act out and get really crazy and become emotional and addicted to crisis and emotion. And others of us, like me, become, you know, I thought it was kind of zen and I thought I was getting nice and quiet and whatever. But in many ways, I was getting sicker and sicker and I was shutting down. As the years went by, I became a quieter and quieter person, and I was becoming shut down in the hopes of dealing with my own sadness and my own pain. I thought, okay, if I can just shut up, you know, if I can just shut up for the year 2001, maybe it won't be so bad.
Right.
And after a while, it didn't work.
No, huh?
No.
What happened?
I guess I started to go a little crazy, and the anger and the fear became too much to deal with. And a lot of people come into the room. There's this kind of joke that you come into the room, you're homicidal or you're suicidal.
Okay.
And I felt a little bit of both when I walked into the room, and the program just started to wash that away. And, you know, one day at a time, week after week, it gets better and better.
Back up to the divorce. What happened on the offset of that? Was that around the time that you came into Al-Anon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is because it was in a way it was a huge gift. You know, my wife decided that our marriage wasn't working out. She wanted to leave.
Was she an alcoholic?
No, she was kind of a workaholic.
You'd said that earlier, but nothing with no chemical abuse.
Nope. No chemical abuse, just addiction to her career, addiction to work. She's a wonderful person and very successful in her field.
Now that you've got a little bit of recovery under your belt, is it coincidental that you picked an unavailable woman?
It's not at all coincidental. And she actually turned out to be very unavailable. She'd actually she turned out she turned out to be non-attracted to me. And after all these years, you know, she turned out to be really unavailable.
Okay. So is that a pattern where you set yourself up in these situations to gain approval from people who you can never really get it from?
It is a pattern, and I'm still living it today. You know, I've started dating recently, and I am intensely attracted to some women who suffer from depression.
Okay.
Women who are
broken,
unavailable. Women who are broken. Women who are addicted. And it's to me, yeah. It's like I pull trash off the street sometimes. Like I'll pull an antique fan off the street and fix it up and sell it. And in a way, that's great.
Yeah,
you know,
that's cool.
You find a fan on the street and then you sell it for $50. That's great. But you don't go out and find a woman who's A, suffering from depression, B, is addicted to cigarettes and alcohol. I'm not looking for a fixer-upper, and yet I still do it. It's like as children of alcoholics, it's amazing. We can smell alcoholism. We can smell addiction. We can smell the pattern behavior of the Al-Anon family. You can smell it. I can look around a subway car, and I'll be like, wow, I'm attracted to those two women over there. And then after a while, I'm like, oh, you know, I can see it. You know, they don't sleep well. You know, you can see certain things, and it's sad. It's our illness, but... And I'm sure, you know, I'm never going to be perfect. It's one day at a time. But I do hope that as I go on in life, I will attract people and be attracted to people who are healthier.
Well, that's the next question I had for you. What do you suppose is the block between you and a healthy woman?
The block.
Or do you find healthier women threatening or unattractive?
I find them unattractive.
Okay. Is it the chaos?
I find them boring.
Is it the chaos that you're craving?
I crave the chaos. I crave the project, you know. It's like I was a witness for so many years. I was a witness to my mother's sadness, my mother's longing, my mother's depression. She divorced her second husband. He later died from alcoholism and cigarette addiction.
Mm.
And she was sad about that, you know. And so in some ways, I'm trying to invent this time machine where I go back in time and trying to be with my mother who's suffering. So I'm looking for these suffering women.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping as the years go by, as the days go by, that I will learn to love myself. That's one of my greatest goals. If I can find a higher power through the program, if I can learn to love myself through the program, then I won't go looking for these crazy fixer-upper relationships.
And so far, so good.
Yeah, one day at a time.
Excellent. Christopher, thank you so much for sharing. You're listening to America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew. This is Steppin' Out.